What do you think? Is the internet and our 24/7 culture of connection to and through multiple screens our doom or our deliverance? There's certainly a ready supply of folks who tell you it's bad for us. Some recent book titles: Distracted, The Erosion of Attention, and The Coming Dark Age by Maggie Jackson. The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains by Nicholas Carr. The Dumbest Generation, How the Digital Age Stupefies Young Americans and Jeopardizes Our Future by Mark Bauerlein. And I interviewed Sherry Turkle earlier this year about her latest book, Alone Together, Why We Expect More from Technology and Less from Each Other. Today's guest, Tiffany Schlain, has a different take. She believes that the culture and the experience possible for billions today and in the future through our technological connectivity may usher in the next stage of our evolution. She titles her Dune documentary Connected and subtitles it A Declaration of Interdependence. In Connected, Schlain weaves her hopes about the possibilities of a connected global society with the cancer battles and eventual passing of her father, author Leonard Schlain, himself a guest more than once on the show, as well as her own high-risk pregnancy. The film opens the 30th of September at the Arclight Hollywood and continues at three theaters currently in the Bay Area, opens at the Angelica in New York the 14th of October. Tiffany Schlain, honored by Newsweek, is one of the women shaping the 21st century, is a filmmaker, artist, founder of the Webby Awards, co-founder of the International Academy of Digital Arts and Sciences, and a Henry Crown Fellow of the Aspen Institute. Her films include Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness, about reproductive rights in America, The Tribe, an exploration of American Jewish identity through the history of the Barbie doll, Yelp, with apologies to Allen Ginsberg's Howl, about our addiction to technology and the importance of unplugging, and as I said, her newest, Connected, A Declaration of Interdependence. Tiffany Schlain also presented the 2010 campus-wide commencement address at UC Berkeley. Welcome, Tiffany Schlain.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here.
Yeah, it's really a pleasure to have you here. As I said, and we've commented as we were, putting this thing together, your father, Leonard, was a personal friend and was a guest on this show a couple of times on one of his books, The Alphabet Versus the Goddess, and on the other one, Sex, Time, and Power. And it's been, I suppose I knew your dad since about the year 2000, so I've been sort of watching your career blossom through his proud eyes. So let me ask you, as I do everybody, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we end up talking about. And although I know we're going to talk about your personal life perhaps throughout the show because your film involves so much of your own personal life and your family life and so on. But still, can we start by you telling us a bit about your path to the work that you do? And feel free to include mentors or turning points or moments of decision.
Sure. I grew up in Northern California in the 70s, which was a very particular time. My dad built a geodesic dome in our backyard. I was very influenced by Buckminster Fuller. And my mother went back to school to get her PhD when I was 8 in psychology. So I'm very close with both of my parents, and they really shaped me in many ways. And my family are Russian Jews, and I was always fascinated with Russia, and because they never wanted to talk about it, and the Soviet Union was considered an enemy country, which made it equally fascinating. So I was given a Macintosh computer when I was 14. I was a total computer geek. I had the old Apple IIe's. Anyways, I was very excited in 1984, the idea of connecting my Mac to the library modem, and the idea that I could maybe connect with students in enemy countries like the Soviet Union, and maybe we could talk about how we're all the same, and maybe I could help bring world peace. I laugh when I say that because it was just like, I had this best friend whose family was from Iran, and she was also from an enemy country. So we spent a lot of time talking about how could we use these computers to make the world better. So we wrote this proposal called UNITAS, which stood for Uniting Nations in Telecommunications and Software. And from that just simple couple-page proposal, I was invited to be a student ambassador in the Soviet Union in 1988. And I went over there wanting to talk about the power of technology and power of personal computers to bring people together. But, you know, many of them didn't even have enough food, so the idea of having a computer was just, you know, obviously someone from Northern California that had enough money to have a computer. It was just an idea that was really unrealistic at the time. But right after that, I went to UC Berkeley, and I studied film theory and film production, and I had this wonderful mentor there named Marilyn Fabe, who was my film theory professor. And she had this infectious excitement about talking about how every time there was a new technological advance in film, how much it changed the culture. So I was really interested in film and documentary and avant-garde film in terms of exchanging ideas. So when I graduated from Berkeley, I used to pay for my films by working in technology, and I went kind of back and forth between technology and film. And then I was working on this CD-ROM about the musician Sting, and someone said to me, you have to see this thing called The Web. People from all over the world are talking about how much they love Sting's music. And from that moment, when I saw The Web, which was, I think, 1994 or 1995, I thought, that is the framework that's going to change the world. And then shortly thereafter, I was given the opportunity to found the Webby Awards, which honors the world's best websites. This is about 15 years ago. And then I spent about a decade of my life establishing the Webby Awards, honoring the best websites, people doing pioneering work in it. And throughout all of that, I was making short films about how technology was changing our lives. But then I really wanted to get back to filmmaking more, and I wanted to have children. And so I sold the Webby's about 5 years ago. And then I had been making films combined with the power of the web to hopefully make the world a better place. And I even think of myself more of a conversation maker more than a filmmaker, because my goal with all of my films is really to get people talking about complicated issues, give them enough tools to come at it from all these different perspectives, and I think there's many good ripple effects from conversations.
Excellent. Thank you, Tiffany. Let me say one thing. Your path was interesting in a number of things. That notion of, you know, early on, that a technology which you had, but the folks you ended up visiting in the Soviet Union inspired you to write a proposal that got you to the Soviet Union. So despite the fact that you couldn't do what you thought you would do, I can imagine that the experience to a young teenager must have been profound.
Absolutely. I mean, it was so profound to just, I think also I was searching so much for my roots as a Russian Jew. And mm-hmm. I think I really understood how much, those weren't my, you know, core. I was searching for something I wouldn't find there. And then also just seeing, you know, if you're from a privileged family in Northern California, every kid should go to different parts of the world and see how everyone else lives. So it was profound on a number of levels. And I look forward to going back there. We actually named our daughter Odessa. Our family's from Odessa. So someday I hope to take her to Odessa, and hopefully the world's a little better over there now.
Yeah, the news just last yesterday that Medvedev has asked Putin to run again for president. What? No surprise there, huh?
Yeah.
So that he will again have the actual title, not just the power. Talk just a little bit about the Webbies. It sounds like, I mean, you started them fairly early on. What was your hope? How did they evolve, and what did they mean to you or to the field?
Well, I felt, you know, it was really early on, and, you know, everyone was experimenting, as they still are. But back then, it was only, like, you know, thousands of people on the web, if you can imagine. I mean, now, just to give you a sense, there's 2 billion people online. But when I was starting the Webby Awards, there wasn't that many people, and so what we were trying to do is, when something's in such an early stage, if you honor the best and you say, look, everyone try to get past this, you know, place of of the best. You kind of hope that you keep pushing it forward because everyone then gets this ideal of excellence.
Mm-hmm. You set the bar.
You set the bar, and everyone, the great thing about the web is you can, once you learn how someone does it, you can do it and then push beyond it. You know, all the code, anyone can see it. Anyone can see how you're doing something. So we were, our hope was to continue to help push this young medium forward and honor people for their work, which everyone's human. Everyone loves to be honored. Many people were never told they did a great job by their parents, which is so important. So we felt like we, you know, we're telling in a very big, exaggerated way, good job.
Yeah.
Doing great work. Push it forward. So it was a really beautiful period of my life. I worked so hard. I worked crazy hours, like 80-hour weeks. Then the internet exploded. And, you know, there was one point where Mayor Giuliani in New York tried to bring the Webby Awards there. We were based in San Francisco at the time. And then the internet was on the cover of everything. And here I was like 26, 27, 28 years old, being courted by two mayors. And the show got bigger and bigger and more sponsors. And it was this crazy, surreal time. I'll never forget when Google had just launched and the two founders rollerbladed onto the stage with capes. And, you know, it felt like if you were under 30 in San Francisco, you were at the center of the universe. And then, you know, and then everything crashed with the internet crashed. And then 9/11 happened, which I would call the real crash. And I think everybody in the world, especially in America, started reevaluating what they're doing with their lives. And I had been incredibly blessed to have been able to ride this wave and honor people. But I also knew, you know, I'd fallen in love. I was married. I wanted to have children. I did not want to work 80-hour a week. I wanted to make change in the world. So while I was doing the Webby Awards, Bush had gotten into power, and the first thing he did was take away funding from international family planning, so basically women's planning, reproductive
choice,
right,
yeah.
Support all over the world. And I thought, okay, I've been so blessed in my career. I'm going to make a film about the importance of reproductive choice in America. It was before the elections. I made this short film. And, you know, got into Sundance. It played all at all the Planned Parenthoods all over the country for the 30-year anniversary of Roe v. Wade. And, you know, here I had made this short film, and it played everywhere, and it didn't need me to recreate it every year like the Webbies did. And I thought, that's it. I need to go back to my first love, which is filmmaking, combined with the power of the web, and make work smarter and have more impact. So that's when I started looking for someone to buy it, and then, you know, I was with it for nearly a decade. And then, you know, now I do a lot of work with film combined with the web, combined with live events, combined with tools.
Yeah, very good. That's the voice of Tiffany Schlein, as you could hear, founder of the Webbies, director of a new documentary, Connected, which opens in L.A. September 30th. You can learn more at TiffanySchlein.com and ConnectedTheFilm.com. Another thing that struck me, you said that actually, and this makes great sense to me, that you feel that, in fact, your role may be to start and participate in conversations more than it is to make this object or this product. And I must say, I mean, obviously, that's my hope for what I'm doing, you know, is not that I'm making hours of our conversation, but that the hour of our conversation stimulates other conversations out there. And luckily, speaking about the technological era, the era of the podcast certainly transforms that possibility within radio. And let me read a quote. You said that I hope Connected, this is in your director statement, will help create a global conversation about what it means to be connected in the 21st century. I believe that by engaging people to talk about connectedness in their own lives and in the world, the ripple effect will have far-reaching impact. And it's interesting. Connectedness, as we will talk about in your film, I imagine that it began, the original meaning when you set out was the 24/7 technological connection, but then with your pregnancy during the making of the film and your father's brain cancer, seems to be become about some other kinds of connections at least equally as much.
Yeah, when I set out to make the film, it was to be a feature documentary about what does it mean to be connected in the 21st century, kind of a historical context and where I think we're moving forward. And I asked my father to be a co-writer along with my husband and my writing team, and That was what we were making. And then I'll never forget this very sinking feeling that I had in the editing room when I watched 2 years into it. And I watched the whole cut from beginning to end. And it was interesting and provocative, but I wasn't connected to it. And I had such a sinking feeling. And here, my father had just been diagnosed with brain cancer and given 9 months to live the same week I found out I was pregnant, which was, of course, 9 months. And I was just shell-shocked. And I couldn't believe I wasn't exploring emotional connectedness. I couldn't believe that I hadn't approached it that way.
That your blind spot, right?
It was like, I couldn't believe it. Like, how can I not be looking at this from an emotional lens? Because we all connect to everything, starting with our parents, starting with the people we love, then to our community, then out to the world. We're all children. That is actually something that binds every single one of us, is we are all children of two people.
Yeah. And I would say, I mean, I'm sure this is what you're saying, is that all the speculation in the world about what might happen to technology pales if yes. people don't have it in their lives.
That's right. And so then I started this very typical process of weaving in my own story of connectedness with this larger story of humanity's connectedness. And it really weaves back and forth, because originally it was all very left brain, idea focused. And then I started weaving in the heart and the right brain. And the film goes back and forth between me narrating it and Peter Coyote, who is our voice of God, our narrator.
Yeah.
And then by the third act, we start weaving and switching off those roles. And now when I look at the film, I can't believe the film was any other way. But for 2 years, I was not in it. So then we changed the tagline to an autoblogography about love, death, and technology. And, you know, autoblogography is obviously a nod to autobiography and also to the technological angle we take. But we really do give a historical context to the history of connectedness, where I hope we're going. And, you know, the film, since I've made it, I've actually made a lot of changes. And actually, since my father passed away, I think whenever you have someone you love who's dying, you really think a lot about time and about life. And since we made it, my family, my husband and children and I take technology Shabbats, which are 24 hours every week that we completely unplug and we're just completely present with each other. And I think through all these intoxicating technologies and everything, we just can't forget to be present with the people that we love, or present with our own thoughts and ideas, and not be able to act on every single thought, every single moment.
Right. And for anyone that word is new to, Shabbat is the Hebrew word for Sabbath. And in Orthodox families, one would have that Shabbat at sundown Friday to sundown Saturday, in which you wouldn't turn on an electric light, et cetera, et cetera. But what you're doing is your own creation.
I'm bringing it into the 21st century, and I'm saying that anyone, whatever faith you subscribe to or whatever, there could probably be some value in taking one day off of all of these tools, these technologies, because there is value in having one day of rest,
yeah.
one day to rebalance and regrow. You know, it's very important.
Yeah. Tiffany Schlein, let's talk a little bit about your dad, Leonard Schlein. I describe him to other people. The first thing I say, of course, is the kind of Renaissance man that he was, that I believe one of the inventors or developers of laparoscopic surgery, you know, no mean feat. There you go. That's enough, right? And then head of department at one of the major hospitals in San Francisco. And then I say, and in his off time, as a hobby, he wrote Art and Physics, Alphabet versus the Goddess, Sex, Time, and Power, and was working on his book until he passed, which I assume you folks are going to finish and
yes.
put out somehow, Leonardo's Brain, which, when you think about it, if anyone does, those are books that in their, you know, Art and Physics, or which is obvious. The others are the title might not tell you, but what he did was he got huge questions and then did enormous research and then had big ideas and so on. Quite unique. And he was a phenomenal – I'm going to ask you to talk a bit about Leonard, but either, you know, Leonard the public figure or the enormous influence that Leonard Schlein was on you.
Yeah, I mean, he was just one of those brilliant, original people. He was just such an original. And he was an incredible father and just an incredible person. The best part of these screenings, we just had a premiere in Portland, and I guess, you know, he had spoken a lot in Portland, and all of his fans came out, and he just inspires so many people. So what's really exciting at the screenings is that there's a lot of people that hear about the film because of my work, but a lot of people hear about it because of my father's work. And a lot of his ideas from Alphabet vs. the Goddess in Arm Physics and his new book, Leonardo's Brain, I've woven into the film. So they are also an idea arc in the movie. And he just, you know, sharing him and his ideas and his way of living has been one of the best parts because, you know, he was the guy that all of our friends would bring their report card to. They would show their report card to my dad. And he would just get so proud of them and just beam. And he was that guy. Everyone said to me, you know, your father made me feel like the most important person in the room. And I think today there's a lack of that with all this distraction and everyone like not focusing. So, so it's exciting too. There's a lot of people in the theaters that are learning about his work for the first time too. So that's super exciting. And then I should point all of your listeners, we're having a very exciting kind of conversation online on our Facebook page, which is Connected to Film. And it's been very exciting. A lot of people posting my dad's old talks or articles. So it's just the film really explores a lot about him. And, you know, I feel like I never really understood this. I never really had someone very close to me die that close. And you know how when people say, oh, they live on through you. And they really do. Like, I feel like he's everywhere now. I mean, even as I'm talking to you, he's here and he's smiling. And so many of his ideas I speak about now, and he's taught me so much. And my mother, who's alive, I'm very close with. And you just understand how, you know, the influence that your parents have on you. And, you know, I think the other thing I can say is that I know my father's and my relationship was very special because we were very close. But the film really deals with connection, whoever you're connected to on a deep level, because that's what life's really all about. And as I get older, when I connect with someone, I'm connecting with someone. We're sharing some big thing that happened. That's when you really connect. And so to be able, and so many people have lost their parents, or they will, and it's going to be profound no matter your relationship to them. It's going to be a profound experience. And in our world today, there's so much talk of being connected. And this film goes to the fundamental heart of connected, which is your relationship with someone you love very much.
Yeah. And I, as I shared with you off air, my father passed away a year and a half ago. And there's nothing like it.
Yeah.
You know, that's just the way it is. That's the voice of Tiffany Schlain, founder of the Webbies, director of a new documentary, which we're talking about, Connected. It opens in Los Angeles at the ArcLight Hollywood Friday, September 30th. And you will be there doing Q&A just that night, just the first night?
Well, I'll do a Q&A at the, you know, they don't do the show times until they'll list them on Monday, but either the 7 or 7:30 screen,
right.
I'll be doing a Q&A. Q&As have been wonderful, just wonderful conversations have come from them. And then there's also, I'll be at a Q&A for the Sunday screening, late afternoon one. So if people are interested in coming when I'm there, if they go to our Facebook page, connectedtofilm.com, we will update and post all the Q&As and special events happening with the film. We'll be playing there for a week. You know, opening weekends are super important for documentaries, so if you want to come, it'd be great to go on the opening weekend. And it's going to be, you know, the premieres, we've had sold-out audiences in the Bay Area. We had a great premiere in Portland Friday. And they're really exciting because people are ready to talk about this stuff. I just feel like we've all been moving so quickly with all these tools, and there hasn't been a lot of stopping and talking about what it means. And people are ready to have the conversation, which is great.
Okay. I'm going to quote your father because it's early in your film, and I think very much what we're talking about right now, which is that he used to quote Sophocles, "Nothing vast enters the life of mortals without a curse."
Yeah.
And I mentioned at the top in the intro, the interview I did earlier this year with Sherry Turkle.
Yes.
And I assume you folks are friends and colleagues and so
we are
on.
Friends.
And her experience, you know, she did she's done a trilogy on our technological connectivity and our life through screens and so on. And she has long celebrated the phenomenon. But in her latest book, Alone Together, she says, I had missed some things. I hadn't seen what was going to happen. And one of the things she says she missed was the 24/7 nature of it. She it was an interesting point in our conversation where she said, yeah, she knew that people would get phenomenally involved. She knew that there were people who were doing 3-4 hours a day of being someone else in some virtual identity. But she had never, it's so funny, the things we don't foresee, she had never seen that it would be 24/7 for so many of us.
And she said an interesting thing where she said she thought people would be like either in this reality, the real world, or in the online reality. But she didn't imagine that there would be a life mix.
That's right.
We were constantly toggling back, having lunch with a friend, going online, texting about it, then being back in the conversation and checking again, and that there's this blurring of what you're doing in the real world and online. And I think that's an excellent point. I mean, we just had dinner together. She gave a talk at Berkeley. I think she's fantastic. And, you know, but I think she also, I think a lot of people think she completely came down on all things technological. And I have to tell you, people so want to focus on the negative parts of technology. It's amazing. I mean, I feel like that's an important discussion. But let's also talk about the potential of the fact that we will be alive when all people will be connected online, because there's an amazing potential. And any technology we could talk about throughout history and anyone we're using today, I could tell you three great things about it and three really bad things about it, the curse.
Well, I think one of the things she says is not only that people focus on the negative, which, this book, as she said, she didn't say this was a book of condemnation. She said it was a book of redemption, that it was in some sense filling out her experience or her observations, not taking them in the opposite direction. But she said she has been not only have folks who want to agree with her say it's all negative, but that she got some feedback from colleagues and allies who felt she'd betrayed the cause.
I know, it's interesting because I didn't read it that way. I saw the nuance. I think people are just so ready. Well, I mean, here's the thing. We should be talking about the curse part. I want to be talking about it. Obviously, I'm taking a day off of technology of the week because I was too distracted and I wasn't present enough with the people I wanted to be. But let's also talk about the potential, because I just read that, you know, there was a strand of AIDS virus and the scientists put it up, made it a video game, and these gamers online figured out the problem. I don't know if you read that.
Oh, absolutely. No. Jane McGonigal, who
right.
I know is another ally of yours,
yeah.
You know, has that wonderful TED Talk, which I highly recommend and have recommended many times to people, in which she says that gamers, gamers will go a long way toward helping us save the world if we give them the opportunity. And when I saw this headline, I was so pleased.
Yeah, because I guess I think, like, we're just at the beginning of seeing how collaborative tools online are going to tackle some of the biggest problems of our day. So, you know, they've shown – Matt Ridley wrote this great book, The Rational Optimist, where he talked about throughout civilization that innovation has occurred usually in cities, because you're getting the most people from different perspectives bumping up against each other around problems and coming up with new solutions that never would have happened because of the diversity of ideas. So suddenly we have this global framework for – people from all different perspectives to gather around the biggest problems of our day, the environment, poverty, you know, you name it, we've got tons. So the exciting part to me is, okay, let's figure out the tools, let's harness this potential, this connectedness, and how can we bring everyone together from their different perspectives to tackle and solve some of these big problems. So that's why I get hopeful. And I also feel, I don't agree. You know, a lot of people say, oh, people are siloed. They're only listening to people that have the same opinion as them, and they're in an echo chamber. I just don't agree. I mean, I'm on Twitter and Facebook, and I feel like I'm more exposed to different and interesting ideas than I ever have been in my life. And as a filmmaker who makes social documentaries, I feel more connected to, you know, the thousands of people that follow my work on Twitter or Facebook. And if I want to make something happen, I get to do it with a click. I can activate a network of people who care about an issue to make stuff happen. So that's very powerful.
I want to mention two other competing documentaries that I have been made aware of that both also open in L.A. September 30th, and I just want to make people aware of them. One is Granito, How to Nail a Dictator, which is a fascinating film directed by Pamela Yates. It opens Lemley Monica 4, and there will be Q&As with the filmmaker on that one. What happens is Pamela Yates in 1982 is a very young filmmaker, made a documentary, an award-winning documentary, When the Mountains Tremble, about the peasant insurrection in Guatemala. Decades later, her outtakes were sought as evidence in an attempt to prove that the generals and the dictator, Rios Montt, at the time, were responsible for genocide in which 200,000 people died. And they were looking to see if whether her outtakes would give any smoking guns to connect them. So it's a fascinating film about the power of film, about the she interviews folks who were young revolutionaries in 1982, now looking back on what's happened and so on. So Granito, How to Nail a Dictator. Another film that opens September 30th at the Lemley Monica 4 also is Finding Joe. It's a documentary on the teachings and the thinking of Joseph Campbell. And for any of you who know, you know, how often we refer on this program to the narrative, the story, the myth, the work of Joseph Campbell is profoundly important. So those are just two other documentaries opening. We've got a bonanza this this coming weekend of documentaries in Los Angeles. Let me ask just one other thing about film. I saw Michael Moore speak this week.
Where did you see him speak?
He spoke here at a thing called Writer's Block.
Okay.
Yeah. And he has opened one of the things that he talked about, which is wonderful because people always just want to talk about the politics, right? But he was also talking about the films, and he has opened a movie theater, or refurbished a movie theater, where he lives in rural Michigan, which he says is doing blockbuster business with art house films in that part of the country that people think is not interested in art house films, independent films, and so on. And he really says that as much as we have so much more ability to get films out there and see films and so on, by looking at them at home or on our screens, he really says that a film is best seen in a darkened space with an audience of others, whether you share the laughter or the gasps or the tears that come up during that film, that communal experience, that connected experience is one of the magical films of film, which he says will never die. And I just wanted to get your thoughts on that.
You know, I completely agree. I mean, it just, there's something after coming from all these premieres and pack houses, and nothing replaces that. So I'm hearing that buzzing. Nothing replaces that feeling of experiencing something with a group of people, that sense of connectedness. So whether you're laughing or crying next to someone or just experiencing a shared experience is very powerful. And I think there's all these new ways to experience ideas, but nothing will replace that. When we're social creatures at our core, it's ultimately what gives me hope in the world, is how much I love to be connected. And so nothing will replace that. So that's why, you know, I'm excited to come down to L.A. I love the Arclight Theater. And I can't wait to really have the Q&A in the audience and to sit in the back of the theater and watch them experience something together.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the film itself. We talked already about the creative process in that the film took four plus years.
Yes.
And that you made a shift about halfway through when you had a semi-finished film that turned out it wasn't the film you needed to make, and then shifted gears. But let's talk about the form. What the form is there is a lot of narration, because you do in the current version, in the final version, you share your experience, you share your thoughts. Occasionally, Peter Coyote talks about the science or the history or something, but the visuals that go on are really a huge part of this film. And let me just set it up this way. I have written songs and screenplays. I've produced music albums. I've directed music videos and documentaries. And I always believe that one of the essential measures of an artist or tasks of an artist or a craftsman is the making of choices. And some forms, some approaches have less choices than others. You tell a narrative film with a very clear narrative story, and you will have less choices than perhaps a documentary where you have the entire world to play with. The visual style that you use, I think you may have more edits per minute than any film I've ever seen.
All of my films are done in that style. I don't have any talking heads. I don't interview anybody. I think, you know, my style actually really came from the fact that when I went to UC Berkeley, they had no film production there. So I learned how to tell stories and make films through recutting old movies. So one of my first films I ever made, I recut a German expressionist movie, the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, and called it The Closet of Dr. Caligari, and it was like an AIDS film, and I constantly was like cutting old movies. So I then studied film production at NYU, but it really has informed my style, because it used to be that I would have to look at old dusty bins for footage, but now I can go on the internet and I can find anything I want. So I'm like a kid in a candy store.
Yeah.
So my movie is like 70% or maybe 60% archival and stock images. The stock images are, they look modern and new, but I didn't shoot them. And then there's about 25% of original animations. I have an amazing animator who I've worked with on 4 films, and his animations are both vintage and modern feeling. And then very little original footage. So to me, the exciting part creatively is the juxtaposition of images and word to create a new idea.
Right. And as I'm saying, when you do what you do, which is, you know, here we have, let's say, a minute. We hear the narration for a minute about the brain science of connectivity or something, or, you know, the evolution of connectivity through technology since the 50s. And what we will see on screen is, you can probably tell me, but is it a cut every second and a half?
Sometimes.
Yeah. Of this footage, where we'll see a cartoon image, and then we'll see an old ad, and then we'll see an old piece of newsreel footage, and then we'll see, and it will just be image after image after image. What I'm getting to, I think, is that in other words, you in some sense have to make more choices per minute than were this film to be done almost any other way. How is that process?
Yeah, it's very exciting to me. I mean, it is. You know, again, sometimes I also feel like I'm kind of teaching you this language in the film. So sometimes at the beginning of the film, I'm going to show you an image. And then at the end of the film, I'm going to re-show you that image, but it'll take on a completely different context.
Mm-hmm.
So it is like I'm playing. I mean, to me, it's like I'm DJing the visual and words to create deeper ideas than you would normally get just having a literal word and image. So I'm using our collective image base, because so many of these images you'll recognize and some you won't, but you feel like you've seen. And
that's right. No, even if we haven't seen that specific 50s suburbia, or we haven't seen that specific factory, or we haven't seen that specific early sci-fi image, we by now they or their relatives have a place in our subconscious.
That's right. Well, you talked about Finding Joe, which was playing at the Maui Film Festival when I was there. I'm so excited to see it. I haven't seen it yet. But, you know, there are these archetypal images that are going to represent certain things for us. So in trying to take a stab at what does it mean to be connected in the 21st century, I wanted to use everything available that is available online. And we're bombarded with images. And in many times, it's not to have an idea, but it's to buy something. But it's like, what if I can give you a montage of images that's going to make you think and laugh and cry and rethink and question. So I'm using, in some ways, some of the same strategies as music videos and commercials, but I'm using it to make you think, which is a whole different agenda than making you want to buy something. So it's very fun. It's my own style. It's its own thing. All of my films are done this way, and Connected kind of takes it to the figure. We just released this film that we crowdsourced, and we released it on Interdependence Day, which was the day after 9/11, and it was in New York, and YouTube featured it on its homepage. And it's a 4-minute film called The Declaration of Interdependence. And in many ways, it explores a lot of the ideas in Connected in real time. But we posted something on the internet and said, everyone read this script. We wrote a 1-minute script and posted it on the internet. And we got entries from Haiti and Rwanda and India and Japan and everywhere. And we edited it into this 4-minute movie and posted it online for free. And it was so exciting because now I'm venturing into not only using the images from all over, but I'm collaborating with people from all over the world.
Quite exciting. How do people find that one?
They can go to connectwiththefilm.com, and if you just click on A Declaration of Interdependence, you can see the movie. And, you know, again, if anyone wants to stay updated on, you know, both when we're in theaters, our Q&As, and all these kind of things we're doing, they can go to our Facebook page. It's so interesting. It's much more active than our website because there's a lot of interesting dialogue going on Connected the Film on Facebook.
Very good. Let's talk just a little bit more about the ideas in the film. When I asked you before about, you know, the shadow side or the curse and the positive side, you talked about the potential for collaboration, the potential for, and I would say collaboration along a very wide continuum, from the collaboration where you're crowdsourcing a 4-minute film, and the collaboration where they had gamers solve an AIDS protein puzzle that scientists had been unable to solve for years. The gamers solved it very quickly, and some of them knew nothing about AIDS. They just knew about games. But there's more. There's sort of a foundational side to what you're talking about as well. One of the points that I think it's rooted in is that human beings are not that fast, not that strong, not that big, our teeth aren't that big, et cetera, et cetera. We survived and arrived where we are today because of our capacity for social cohesion. There's certainly a very positive revisionist analysis of evolution to say that it is that. It is our ability to collaborate, that it is not competition of tooth and claw, so much. It's cooperation and it's the survival of ecosystems, not the survival of individual species or individual organisms. How does that and talk about that and brain chemistry in your look at connectedness?
Absolutely. Well, you know, Fritjof Capra, you know, talked a lot about this. It was not through competition, but cooperation. And I absolutely believe that. I think we've been way too focused on competition as our essence for survival, when really it has been collaboration. And the great thing is that the internet, they've done studies where it opens up more channels for collaboration. And the film, we go into a lot about the brain and how it's changing with all of these new really extensions. A lot of people talk about technology as if it's a separate thing from us. It's just an extension of us, our extension of our desire to connect. And because we're curious, we are curious creatures. Those two things give me so much hope. So I think that in terms of the brain, I think a global brain is merging by everyone connecting. And I don't mean that we're all going to have one thought. And I think that's a trap. When that word comes up, it's like we're not going to have one group think. That's not going to happen. But the exciting part is the diversity of thought when all of the brains are connected. And also in terms of our own brains, you know, watching my father do surgery, sometimes he used to do it for 8 hours at a time. He was incredibly focused. And sometimes I feel like, you know, we're so distracted and we're all over the place. I've got like 7 files open. I'm answering emails, cell phones all at once. And sometimes I really kind of keep myself up about that. And then other times I think, maybe we finally created a work environment that truly mirrors our stream of consciousness, because our stream of consciousness is not a focused thing. It is constantly going and thinking of a new thought that makes you think of another thought. And the web and all of the ways that we work online actually mirrors more how we think.
Let me take two thinkers who I think presage some of what you're talking about. One is Teilhard de Chardin, right? Derek Desjardins in the Phenomenon of Man, a book I highly recommend to anyone who hasn't heard it, or has heard of it but haven't yet read it. I believe it was written in 1938. This guy saw the future, and I was suppressed by the Catholic Church for several years because of it. But he posited that there would emerge something called the noosphere, a kind of global nervous system that would unite us all. I assume you're familiar with him. How have you thought about his thoughts in terms of what what we're talking about right now?
I think it is realized today. We have created, and we've always been connected, you know, biologically. And then we were connected economically and through communication. And suddenly, we have created a central nervous system around the world through these new technologies. Now, not everyone's on yet, but they will be. I mean, mobile phones are going to just link everyone up very quickly, quicker than anyone thinks. They are the $100 computer. And so the idea that something can happen in Haiti and everybody can respond immediately, or Arab Spring happens and suddenly everyone can be watching that and experiencing that live over the web, I mean, that's only going to happen more and more. So we suddenly have created this central nervous system, which he talked about many, many years ago. It's happening. We have such a strong desire to connect and to evolve, and are so curious that we're just like linking together all the people. And so to activate that network, I mean, at times that can be overwhelming, but the great thing about an interconnected network like that is that a small change in an interdependent system can have an amazing ripple effect. So I'm excited about the ripple effects of so many of these ideas and things that are happening, and even this small film that we made, that we put out on the internet, made from people on the internet and then put out. What's so exciting about that is you can kind of activate in a beautiful way this network. And I think, of course, the media is constantly focusing on the worst aspects of the network being connected. And whether it's the financial crisis or terrorism and all these things, but there's a lot of beautiful ways. And I just truly believe that we should also be talking about the potential and the hope of the central nervous system that we have evolved to create. And what is the power of that to help make this world better?
You know, I had Robin Wright on last week talking about the Middle East. And mm-hmm. One of the things that was profound for her was that she has been doing the hard reporter's research on the potential for reform in the Middle East for years. Who are mm-hmm. the reformers? When are they going to, you know, when is this one going to get out of jail? Is this one going to mm-hmm. survive? And she was blindsided by how mm-hmm. quickly it went from, you know, there's things happening you haven't heard about, to what she calls the Arab Awakening. And mm-hmm. and it is very clear in her book the role of Facebook, the role of the mm-hmm. internet in doing something which, as even someone who was had her ear to the ground was surprised at how quickly it finally, you know, not that it's over, and you know, certainly in Syria, Bahrain.
No, and the verdict is out. What's going to happen?
That's right.
But the fact that it used to be government controlling information, the difference of that to people sharing ideas, information, we're never going back. We're never going back. And that is very powerful everywhere in the world. To have people be able to broadcast information, share it, learn from it, add to it, we're never going back. And having people have access to that information all over the world is incredibly exciting to me. For people to have the access to all of this knowledge and to share what we've learned and kind of see things from different ways, that's where I get excited. Now, I absolutely think we need to talk about the curse. Talk about when it's not good to plug in on a personal level. Talk about what the bad things that can happen. Talk about privacy. Talk about all these issues that are absolutely there. But there's a lot of potential and excitement about where we are in civilization right now. And that is also an important conversation now, because we can shape it. I think a lot of people talk as if we're just being swept along in
right.
this existence. All these tools are taking over our lives. We have no agency. We do have agency.
Yeah.
If we want to focus on the worst of humanity, you know what? It's going to look really bad. If we want to say, how can we make it better? How can we start thinking of tools? I've shown the film a lot at all the tech companies in Silicon Valley, and it's been very exciting, the conversations that came from that. Because, you know, we can make this world what we want it to be. And if we talk about it And hopefully this film is, you know, we have a whole discussion that goes with the film. We have a curriculum for educators that's currently being used at all these universities. And we really want to start a global conversation. So the film's being shown in all these different countries. And next year we want to do a global simulcast screening. We want to get this conversation started because good things will come from it if we feel empowered on where we go.
Right. Well, I mean, it's obvious that this film, with its life on Facebook or its life on the web, when it's only been seen by a few people relative to, right? I mean, there have been screenings. It's been open in only a few cities. And so it's clear that this film can have a life that exceeds the number of people who will ever see it in the theater. And it also means in a way that it's never, that the film is never finished. Because
that's
the
right.
conversation goes on.
It's the other part of it. That's
yeah, exactly.
Right.
Let me finally, I want to tell you, I took an independent study on Marshall McLuhan in college, mm-hmm. right? 1969, that's the year a lot of social unrest, protests against the Vietnam War, the strike at Harvard that year. Very, very, you know, a very pregnant but a very tough time. And I wrote a paper at the end of that, in aphorisms, which McLuhan's one of his favorite forms. And what I said was, it looked pretty clear that the people would never be able to beat what I called the system at the game of violence or domination. But I asked whether we might triumph at the game of creativity. And I asked if there might emerge, this is 1969, a medium of communication that could not be corrupted because in its very form, it communicated something essential, some quality that might bring out our best, perhaps a kind of authenticity or transparency, something nearly telepathy. What's your response to a crazy, you know, college kid's idea like that? And you've got about a minute and a half.
I think that college kid is pretty brilliant. Kind of named it. And, you know, I've heard about you for years from my dad. And it's great to be talking to you, and I think that's a great idea whose time has come. We're seeing it, we're living it, and it's a very, very exciting moment in history.
Very good. So the film again, and thank you, the film again is Connected. The websites are TiffanySchlain.com, S-H-L-A-I-N, where you get the broader picture of Tiffany's other films and other work, and then connectedthefilm.com, where you get to join the conversation, as we talked about, that is going on around the film. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others anytime during the week by linking to our podcast. You can sign up to have it delivered to you weekly for podcast articles and transcripts of interviews, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work. Go to TerrenceMcNally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. You can sign up at the site or at iTunes to have it delivered to you weekly. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement of upcoming guests, issues, and some usually about two or three background articles, email me at TeMcNally@Mac.com. You can also sign up at my site. Finally, thank you to Tiffany Schlain. Keep up the good work.